45. The Running Dogs of Imperialism. Clara and the other girls from the Institute were subjected to a hair-raising briefing by the saturnine Major Sheikin. She learned that she would be working among most dangerous spies, running dogs of world imperialism and the American Intelligence Service, who had sold their motherland for a song. Clara was assigned to the vacuum laboratory. This was the name given to the laboratory that made to order the numerous electronic tubes required by the other labs. The tubes were blown first in the little glass-blowing shop next door, then emptied of air by three humming vacuum pumps in the vacuum laboratory proper, a large dim room facing north. The pumps divided the room like a row of cabinets. Electric bulbs burned there even in the daytime. The floor was paved with flagstones, and the clatter of shoes and scraping of chair legs never ceased. Each pump had its own vacuum man, a prisoner, sitting or pacing beside it. Other prisoners sat at little desks in two or three places. The only free employees were a girl named Tamara and the captain in charge of the laboratory. Clara had been introduced to this boss of hers in Yakonov's office. He was a plump, middle-aged Jew with an apathetic air. He made no attempt to frighten Clara further, just nodded to her to follow him.
"You, of course, know nothing and can do nothing?" he asked her, out on the stairway.
Clara mumbled something. As if being frightened was not enough, she would now be put to shame, exposed at any moment as an ignoramus and made a laughingstock. She entered the lab inhabited by monsters in blue overalls, as though it were a cage of wild animals. She was afraid even to raise her eyes. The three vacuum men really did look like caged animals, pacing beside their pumps. They had an urgent order and had been denied sleep for 2 days running. But the prisoner by the second pump, a man in his 40s, with a bald spot and in need of a shave, stopped, beamed, and said, "Hey, reinforcements!" Her fears vanished at once. There was so much simple good nature in this exclamation that Clara had to make an effort not to smile in return. The youngest of the vacuum men, the one with the smallest pump, also stopped. He was hardly more than a boy, with a mischievous face and innocent eyes. The look he gave Clara was that of a man taken aback. No young man had ever looked at her like that before. The oldest of the vacuum men was Dvayetsyosov, whose pump, the huge one farther down the room, hummed loudest of all. He was tall, ungainly, lean except for his pendulous belly. He threw Clara a contemptuous glance from a distance and retreated behind his cabinet, as though to spare himself the sight of anything so disgusting. Clara discovered later that there was no need to feel offended by this. He was the same with all the free staff, and when any of the bosses came in, he would deliberately switch on something noisy so that they would have to shout above the din. He was unashamedly careless of his appearance, could turn up with the last of his trouser buttons dangling loose at the end of a long thread, or with a hole in the back of his overalls, and would thrust his hand inside his overalls to scratch with women present. He liked to say, "Look, this is my own country. Why should I worry about what anybody else thinks?" The prisoners, even the young ones, called the middle vacuum man simply Zemelya, which he didn't seem to mind in the least. His was a sunny nature, and he never stopped grinning from ear to ear. Watching him closely in the weeks that followed, Clara noticed that he showed no regret for whatever was lost beyond recall, whether it was an irretrievable pencil or his blighted life. He was never angry about anything or with anyone, nor was he afraid of anyone. He was a really good engineer, but his expertise was airplane engines. He had been delivered to Marfino in error, had made himself at home, and was in no hurry to move on, rightly considering that the next place was unlikely to be better. When the pumps were quieter in the evening, Zemelya liked to reminisce or listen to someone else's stories.
"You just took your 5 kopeck piece and bought whatever you wanted," he said, smiling broadly. "Every step you took, there were people offering you something. It was all good stuff. Nobody tried to sell you crap. If you bought boots, they really were boots. They'd last 10 years without a repair, or 15 repaired. They didn't snip off the leather at the toe caps like they do now. They took it under the welt so that it went right around the foot. Then there were those fancy red boots, what did they call them, with the crepe soles. It was a treat to wear them."
He dissolved into smiles and screwed up his eyes, as though he were looking at a warm but not very bright sun.
Or take railway stations. You never saw anybody lying on the floor or sweltering all day and night outside the ticket office. It took you just 1 minute to buy a ticket and get a seat. There was always room in the cars. They made the trains go fast. They weren't out to save coal. That's how it was. Living was simple, very simple in those days.
The oldest vacuum man would waddle out of the dark corner where his desk was safely hidden from the bosses, hands deep in pockets, to listen to these stories. He would take his stand in the middle of the room, his protuberant eyes looking quizzically at the speaker over his glasses.
"Zemelia, you mean to say you remember the Tsar?" "Just about," Zemelia said, with an apologetic smile.
Dvoyechosov shook his head.
"Well, you shouldn't. We're supposed to be pumping for socialism."
Zemelia timidly demurred.
"We've been told socialism's built already, Kostya."
"Eh?"
The senior vacuum man was pop-eyed with amazement.
"Yes, since 1933 or thereabouts. You mean when there was that famine in the Ukraine? Wait a bit, though. What are we slogging away for day and night now?" "Building communism, I suppose," said Zemelia, beaming. "You don't say. So that's what it is,"
the senior vacuum man said in an idiotic nasal whine, and shuffled off back to his corner. Clara wasn't sure whether they talked like this for their own amusement or for her benefit, but she didn't report them. Her duties were uncomplicated. She and Tamara worked alternate shifts, from morning till 6 p.m. one day, and from after dinner until 11 p.m. the next. The captain was always there in the morning because the brass might want him in the course of the day. He never turned up in the evening, since he did not aspire to promotion. The girls' main task was to act as duty officers, or, in other words, to keep an eye on the prisoners. By way of training, their boss also gave them little jobs about which there was no urgency. Clara and Tamara saw each other for only about 2 hours a day. Tamara had been working in the establishment for over a year and was at ease with the prisoners. Clara, in fact, suspected that Tamara was on quite intimate terms with one of them and brought him books, which, however, changed hands when no one was looking. Apart from this, Tamara went to an English class there in the institute, in which the pupils were free workers and the teachers, unpaid of course, that was the great advantage, were prisoners. Tamara quickly dispelled Clara's fears that these people might do something awful. In the end, Clara started talking to one of the prisoners herself. Not, to be sure, a political offender, but a petty lawbreaker, one of the very few in Marfino. This was Ivan the glassblower, a superb craftsman, unfortunately for him. His old aunt used to say that he was a golden workman, but a still more golden drunkard. He used to earn a lot, spend a lot on drink, and when drunk, beat his wife and pitch into the neighbours. None of this would have mattered if his path hadn't crossed that of the MGB. An important comrade with no badges of rank summoned him in writing and offered him a job with a salary of 3,000 rubles. Ivan, as it happened, worked in the sort of place where his basic wage was less, but where he could bump it up by piecework. So he forgot who he was dealing with, and asked for 4,000 a month. His highly placed interlocutor offered an extra 200, but Ivan dug his heels in. He was sent packing. The next payday he got drunk and started making a row in the yard. In the past, the militia had turned a deaf ear to complaints, but this time they turned up in force and took Ivan in. He was tried the next day, given 1 year, and taken straight from the court to see the same important person, without badges of rank, who explained that Ivan would be working in the place previously intended for him, only now they would not be paying him for it. If these terms did not suit him, he could go and mine coal in the Arctic Circle. Now Ivan sat in Marfino, blowing cathode ray tubes of all shapes and sizes. His year was nearly over, but his conviction remained on his record, and to avoid being sent away from Moscow, he was begging the authorities to keep him on in the same job as a free worker, at 1,500 rubles if they liked. Nobody else in the Sharashka would have found such an artless tale with such a happy ending at all interesting. There were people in the Sharashka who had spent 50 days in the death cell, and there were people who had known the Pope and Albert Einstein personally. But Clara was shaken by it. It showed that, as Ivan said, they can do just what they like. She was distrustful of the political prisoners, and her cautiously official manner kept them at a distance. But even the glassblower's story was enough to awaken in her mind the suspicion that among these blue-overalled people, others, too, might be completely innocent. If that was so, could her own father have condemned an innocent man in his time? But, once again, there was no one to whom she could put this question, either in the family or at work. Her friendship with Innocenti and that outing of theirs had led to nothing, probably because he and Nara had gone abroad again soon afterward. However, in the course of the year, Clara did at least make a friend, Ernst Golovanov. It wasn't at work that she met him. He was a literary critic, and Dinera brought him home one day. He wasn't much of a beau, scarcely taller than Clara, and standing by himself, he looked shorter. He had a rectangular forehead and a rectangular head on a rectangular trunk. He was only a little older than Clara, but he looked middle-aged. He had a paunch and had obviously never gone in for sports. To tell the truth, the name in his passport was Sonkin, and Golovanov was a pseudonym. But he was a well-read, intellectually mature and interesting man, and already a candidate member of the Writers' Union. They had gone to the Mali Theatre together. The play was Vasa Zhelezneva. It was a dismal affair. The theatre was less than half full, which may have been why the actors seemed half dead. They came on, looking bored, like clerks arriving at the office, and cheered up only when it was time to leave. It was almost humiliating to perform to such a poor house. The make-up and the characters became a silly joke, unworthy of adults. At any moment, somebody, speaking quietly as though in his own sitting room, might break the silence of the audience and say, "Why don't you good people stop this tomfoolery?" And the play would collapse in ruins. The humiliation of the actors was contagious. The whole audience felt as though they were taking part in some deed of shame and were too embarrassed to look at each other. It was just as quiet during the intermissions. Couples exchanged whispered remarks and walked noiselessly about the foyer. Clara and Ernst were among those who trod this measure in the first intermission. Ernst stood up for Gorky, indignantly declaring that the performance was an insult to him, abusing people's artist Zharov as, on this occasion at least, a shameless ham, and, more daring still, condemning the bureaucratic inertia of the Ministry of Culture, which was sapping the vitality of the Soviet theatre with its marvellous tradition of realism and undermining the theatregoers' confidence in it. Ernst spoke as he wrote, in precise and well-rounded prose, never at a loss for words, and never leaving a sentence unfinished even when he was excited. In the second intermission, Clara suggested that they should stay in their seats. "I'll tell you why I'm sick of seeing both Ostrovsky and Gorky," she said. "It's because I'm sick of seeing the power of capital and parental oppression exposed, sick of seeing young girls forced to marry old men. I'm sick and tired of this war against phantoms. 50 years, 100 years on, we're still exercising, still exposing things long vanished. You never see a play about things that do exist. There's some truth in what you say." Ernst looked at Clara curiously and with a kind smile. He had not been mistaken in her. This girl was nothing much to look at, but you'd never be bored with her. "What sort of thing do you mean?" There was nobody in the seats next to them or in the orchestra immediately below. Lowering her voice and trying not to betray any important state secret or the secret of her own sympathy for those people, she told Ernst that she worked with prisoners who had been represented as running dogs of imperialism, but that when she had got to know them better, they had turned out to be such and such. The question that tormented her, maybe Ernst could tell her, could there, did he think, be innocent people among them? Ernst heard her out and answered unhesitatingly, as though he had thought it over before. "There are, of course. That's inevitable, with any penal system." Clara didn't want to think about systems. She was in a hurry to append the glassblower's conclusion. "But, Ernst, that's as good as saying they can do what they want to. That is horrible." Her strong tennis player's hand closed into a fist on the red velvet of the barrier in front of them. Golovanov laid his own short-fingered hand flat on the barrier nearby, but did not cover Clara's hand. He did not take such liberties uninvited.
"No," he said, gently but firmly, "it isn't like that. Who is doing these things? Who is it who wants to do them? It is history. History does what it wants. You and I sometimes find it horrible, Clara, but it's time we were used to the fact that there exists a law of large numbers. The more material involved in a historical event, the greater the likelihood of individual incidental errors, judicial, tactical, ideological, economic, or whatever. We grasp the process only in its basic and determining outlines, and what matters most is the conviction that the process itself is necessary and inevitable. Yes, people sometimes suffer through no fault of their own. What about those killed in battle? Or those who perished quite senselessly in the Ashgabat earthquake? Road victims? As traffic increases, the number of fatal accidents must grow. The wise philosophy of life is to accept that it is an evolutionary process, and that there will be victims at every stage." This explanation seemed to make sense. Clara became thoughtful. The second bell had rung, and the audience reassembled. In the third act, Roek, playing Vasa's younger daughter, suddenly rang true, rang loud and clear, and bade fair to drag the whole play out of the abyss. Clara did not realize herself that what concerned her was not just any innocent man, wherever he might be, someone, say, who might already have rotted away beyond the Arctic Circle in accordance with the law of big numbers, but this youngest vacuum man with the blue eyes and the dark golden complexion, hardly more than a boy in spite of his 23 years. Whenever he saw Clara, and ever since their first meeting, the look of joyous adoration had never left his eyes, and it always excited and confused her. She could not know what allowances had to be made for Rostislav's 2 years in a camp, where he had never seen a woman. All she knew was that for the first time in her life she felt herself an object of enraptured admiration. Admiration of Clara did not, however, dominate his thoughts exclusively. Confined as he was, spending almost his whole day under electric light in a dim laboratory, the young man somehow lived a full, indeed a hectic life. When he was not busy on some contrivance that was not for the boss's eyes, or surreptitiously studying English in working hours, he would be calling up friends in the other laboratories and dashing off to socialize in the hallways. His movements were always impetuous, and at any given moment he seemed to be in the grip of something passionately interesting. Admiring Clara was one of his passionately interesting occupations. As busy as he was, he never neglected his appearance. There was always something immaculately white to be seen beneath the gaudy tie tucked into his overalls. Clara did not know that this was the famous dickie, Rostislav's invention, 1/16th of a prison-issue sheet. The young people whom Clara met outside, Ernst Golovanov in particular, were already on their way up in the world, and in everything they did or said, in their dress, their deportment, their conversation, they were careful not to let themselves down. In Rostislav's company, Clara felt that a weight was lifted from her, that she, too, wanted to behave mischievously. She studied him discreetly, and her sympathy for him grew. She did not believe for a moment that he, of all people, and the good-natured Zemelya, were among those running dogs of imperialism against whom Major Shikin had warned her. She was eager to discover what crime Rostislav in particular had been punished for, and whether he had a long sentence to serve. That he was unmarried, she could see for herself. She hesitated to ask him directly, imagining that such questions would be traumatic because they would resurrect his repugnant past, which he needed to shake off in order to rehabilitate himself. Another 2 months or so went by. Clara was by now at home with them all, and they often discussed in her presence all sorts of idle topics that had nothing to do with their work. Rostislav made a habit of waiting until she was alone in the lab, when the prisoners on the evening shift went to dinner, and looking in to collect something left behind, or to study a bit while it was quiet. During these evening visits, Clara forgot all the operations officer's warnings. The night before, impetuous words had burst from them, sweeping away the pathetic barriers that divide people as floodwater breaks a dam.
The young man had no hideous past to live down. There was nothing to discover, except that he had been wantonly robbed of his youth, and that he had an eager appetite to know and to experience all that he had missed. She learned that he had lived with his mother in a village outside Moscow on a canal side. He had just left school when some Americans from the embassy rented a country home in the village. Ruska and two of his friends were curious and rash enough to go fishing with the Americans twice. They thought that they had gotten away with it, and Ruska was admitted to Moscow University. But that September he was arrested on his way there, quietly, so that his mother did not know for some time where he had gone. The Ministry of State Security, apparently, always tried to arrange things so that the person arrested would not have time to hide anything, and his family and friends could not receive any cryptic message or signal. They put him in the Lubyanka. It was there, in Marfino, that Clara first heard of the prison with that name. The interrogators tried to make Rostislav tell them what assignment American intelligence had given him, and to what secret address he was supposed to report. He was, in his own words, still just a silly kid. He couldn't understand what they were getting at, and he cried all the time. Suddenly, a miracle occurred. No one is ever released from the Lubyanka scot-free, but Ruska was. That was in 1945, and that was as far as he had gotten last night. The unfinished story had kept Clara in a state of suspense all night. This afternoon, ignoring all the rules of vigilance, not to mention the limit set by decorum, she had boldly sat down with Rostislav by his quietly humming pump, and they had resumed their conversation. When the dinner break came, they were like children, taking alternate bites from the same big apple. It seemed strange to them that in all those months they had never really talked before. They had so much to say and so little time. When he impatiently interrupted her, he would touch her hands, and she did not object. But when the others had all left the room, sitting shoulder to shoulder with hands touching, suddenly took on a new meaning. Clara saw those yearning blue eyes looking straight into her own, and Rostislav's voice faltered as he spoke. "Clara, who knows whether we will ever sit together like this again? For me, this is a miracle. I adore you." By now he was holding and caressing her hand. "I may have to spend my whole ruined life in one prison or another. Make me happy. Give me a moment that I can cherish even in solitary confinement. Let me kiss you." Clara felt like a goddess descending into a dungeon where a prisoner lay in chains. Rostislav drew her toward him and pressed his lips to hers in a violent kiss, the kiss of a prisoner for whom restraint had become torture. And she responded. After a time she freed herself and turned away. She was shaken, and her head was spinning.
"Please go away," she begged him.
Rostislav rose and stood before her uncertainly.
"Please leave me alone for now," Clara insisted.
He hesitated. Then he obeyed. He turned around in the doorway, looked at her piteously, imploringly, then almost lurched out of the room. They all came back from the dinner break shortly afterward. Clara dared not raise her eyes to look at Ruska or anyone else. That burning sensation. Was it shame? Not just shame. Happiness, then. If so, a troubled happiness. She heard people saying that the prisoners were to be allowed a New Year's party. She sat still for 3 hours. Only her fingers moving as she braided a little basket for the tree from brightly coloured plastic flexible cord. By now, Ivan the glassblower had returned from seeing his wife, and he blew 2 funny glass imps, armed with what might be rifles, then fashioned a cage from glass rods and hung inside it a bright moon, also of glass, which tinkled mournfully as it swung on its silver thread.